Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 59. Today, we're talking Amazon and value capture in AI. Brett, what did Amazon just do, and is it giving us any clues as to whether or not you can charge thousands and thousands of dollars for AI helpers?
Well, I think it's definitely giving us some evidence that AI is useful. So Amazon, and maybe it's an open question as to whether or not that gives companies license to charge thousands of dollars for AI helpers. Amazon announced that, you know, deploying their own internal AI systems, they were able to upgrade all of their servers to the newest version of Java. The process would have taken 4,500 developer years to do it. They did it in 50 developer days. So if you do the math, they saved about $500 million in upgrading their servers. And they, in doing so, they generated $250 million in annual cost efficiencies and operational efficiencies, at least by their estimate. So they saved $500 million and then they got $250 million a year. So it's, you know, a major kind of productivity advance for Amazon. And clearly, if they had been forced to pay for that, they should have paid a large sum. Since they're using their own internal systems, you know, it's amortized CapEx. So it's not clear that they paid much of anything.
Yeah. And I think another dynamic, right? Or it's two 10X engineers and then it's only 450 developer years. But it's like you never have a 10X engineer doing that type of project to begin with, which is separate conversation to go into. But right, I heard this news and it connected the dots with how we've been talking about AI and also a slide that was presented at Coatue's East Meets West, right? And it's framing how do you justify the return on investment in all of these AI infrastructure projects that people are building out. And it's typically split into two, right? You get the cost saving side, which I think the Amazon is a great example. Or you get the revenue generation side and you take a cut of that. And at least as I began to think about it, it's these might seem equal to the customer, but I think it's extremely difficult for the company who's providing it to capture value in a as efficient way if it's cost savings as opposed to revenue generation. Right. So it's like what makes the Apple Store so powerful is that it's off of revenue generation. What makes, at least in our modeling, the autonomous opportunity so profound is revenue capture, right? And it's like things that lead to cost savings. So 3D printing, I think, would be an example, right? You can do things that you can never do before, but that leads to like savings and efficiencies, and extremely difficult to capture that value because it almost just goes to the end customer as opposed to the supplier. And so I know you've got context, you've got more history than I do in thinking about these things, but this is something that I want to talk through because in my mind, it seems like those two are not actually equal.
Yeah. I mean, and just to kind of like highlight the current controversy in the marketplace, you know, NVIDIA's selling like $100 billion plus of AI chips into its server segment. If you do the math, well, gosh, people need to be generating, depending on how you do run the numbers, you know, $600 or $700 billion in revenue to justify kind of the CapEx that they are investing in these chips. And where does that revenue lie? Where can we find it? And some are arguing, well, it's not going to be anywhere. And so then kind of it's nice for all these companies to spend a lot of money on NVIDIA chips so we can all have very useful language models, but they're never going to recoup their investment. I agree with your framing that it's easier to attach a business model to revenue generation because the company is bringing new revenue in the door. You can always just take a cut. And there's plenty of business models that have worked that way. You know, if you think even genetically modified crops, Monsanto's pitch to farmers was always, we'll increase your yield by 15% and we'll just take effectively a platform fee that you'll pay for our seeds in order to increase yield by that amount. Or the App Store is another great example. And I think over time, the cost efficiency side also can be a valid business model, but maybe monetization doesn't happen as immediately. And so if you think about enterprise software and kind of the pitch that enterprise software makes to companies is give your employees this tool and they'll be more productive. You basically won't have to hire an additional employee to do a task in order to get the same amount of stuff done. And they infiltrate the organization sufficiently that they can raise prices and an organization has a hard time, you know, moving on to another platform. And so I think that they there is a delay in kind of like the monetization capture. But assuming the product is either differentiated or sticky enough, ultimately, I think that the the platform fee should resolve to roughly the same amount.
Do you think that's true, though? It's like it seems even if you look at like Microsoft Suite, maybe they're actually capturing more value that way because there's alternatives to all of those and no one uses them, right? Everyone could use Google Sheets or whatnot. But it's like I feel like it's much harder to capture all of the value or even to really become a defensible player if you're only on the cost saving side.
Well, I think take the Amazon example, there's, you know, cost savings ultimately results in revenue generation in some way. So I think an interesting question for Amazon, and you alluded to it, is if you could just spend $500 million on developer hours and get yourself $250 million in cost efficiencies per year going forward, clearly that would have been good money to spend even before you had an AI system. Like why did you wait to do that until this AI system was available? And it's because it's not kind of like their core business. You wouldn't onboard a lot of developers to do it because there's inefficiencies in hiring people and getting them motivated and getting them aligned on doing it. It's boring and laborious work that, you know, was probably on somebody's rank of things to do. It just never was a focus because there was such a, it's a big number, but for Amazon, it's within the context of their business, it's a relatively small number. So ultimately, though, that $250 million in cost savings also provides a lot of operational agility. Like, there's a lot more stuff that they'll be able to do having made that upgrade. And I think the same is true for kind of getting onto a software ecosystem that, yes, it prevents you from having to hire someone. Also, if it's well designed, it helps you do more and generate more revenue. And kind of, it means you hire in more employees. And if it's a per seat pricing, that results in more pricing for kind of like the companies enabling that behavior. And I think that there's a, you know, ultimately kind of like they're just two sides. They're like the revenue line or the OpEx line on the income statement. You know, companies will optimize to ultimately their profitability. And so, you know, they will pay for either one. I think there is a difference in like just being able to like take revenue before it flows into the company, I think, rather than try to charge afterwards.
Or I was going to say, what about even just thinking about, it's almost like a call option versus puts, right? Whereas for me, the difficulty is if you're going on the cost saving side, right? It's like the most you can make is it goes to zero, right? And so then it's like from a competition side, I'm saving you money. A competitor comes and says, okay, I'll save you another, you know, 5 cents. And then someone comes in and say, I'll save you another 5 cents. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's a commodity product. Whereas if you're in the revenue side, like if someone, it doesn't matter because it's all upside. And it's like, that's where you can truly grow and, you know, compete on different things, but it's not, revenue generation doesn't lead to commoditization. And at least from what we've seen, AI thus far has been cost saving dominated.
Well, within existing companies, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Couldn't on the revenue side, do you see commoditization? As in, what I find so fascinating about this space is there really is no serious moat to building software products anymore. Where it used to be, you had to go out and find the best talent to create the best product, and you know, it was part infrastructure, so physical, and then also software, obviously. Today it's just, you know, you rent cloud and you deploy this large language model. And in every instance where we've seen a product come out that's built on a large language model, within the next week or two, we see an open source free version of it. And so I find it very hard to believe that there is a ton of opportunity from what we're seeing today. And I think that it's, you know, massively potentially deflationary. And then also just, I think a lot of this will be commoditized out and bundled, right? I think Sam, you had alluded to it before, but bundling is extremely powerful in the software stack. And it's why you don't see companies able to flex the pricing power they might have, because you always have someone bigger out there willing to give away what you've built for free. Like the amount of services we have as consumers and enterprises for free, for relatively no cost, that we rely extremely heavily on is actually like insane. Like I'll just like think about a mapping service, right? It's free. I couldn't go 5 miles from my house without turning on a map. And that should be something that, you know, to the value it provides to me, something I'm willing to pay for, but yet I don't because it's given to me for free. And there's thousands of examples of this across both the consumer and the enterprise side. And I think AI just accelerates what companies will be willing to give away for free.
I think that's true. And I think there's a difference between the consumer side versus the enterprise side. You know, the mapping services are interesting because you did used to have to pay. And now you don't. And if you own various legacy automakers, you still have to pay for the mapping system on their stupid infotainment screen, which seems insane. At least Google monetizes that to some degree through advertising. So there's indirect monetization. Right. On the enterprise side, I think you said something that I think is an important point with regards to this discussion, if you're doing revenue capture, if you're saying I'm going to deliver you revenue and I'm just going to take a percentage of that, you are also guaranteeing performance of the underlying software, right? And so it's almost like if you're doing cost efficiencies, you're asking a company to pay you up front for something on the promise that it will deliver cost efficiencies. If you're doing revenue capture, you're saying, I'm going to yield you additional revenue, and you're really only paying me for demonstrating that performance. So it's actually a business model attached to a performance guarantee. It's easier to charge somebody something as the performance is delivered rather than trying to charge them up front on the promise of future performance. And so I think that's one way there's a shift. And particularly with AI systems, there is a lot of drift between kind of like the prototype and the actual product being delivered across all of the models in all of the systems right now. And so if I were to imagine kind of an AI system that is going to monetize very well and establish a good competitive moat, I would probably be trying to design to something that goes out there and generates revenue, because then you don't really care. You're just like, oh, this is an AI sales agent that can call 30,000 numbers at a time and kind of generate incremental sales for me. And it's just taking, you know, a share of the transactions it facilitates. That is a product that would be, once deployed, hard to displace, because suddenly you have, like Google AdWords, you have like lots of revenue dependent upon kind of like that particular product. And so you're loath to be like, oh, I'm going to try to rip and replace this with something else, which then will interrupt this revenue stream that you've identified.
Mm-hmm. Why haven't we seen more of those yet? Or you think that's the next wave that's coming?
I think those take longer to develop, probably. I think AI systems generally are probably underperformant relative to the more aggressive use cases that businesses are trying to deploy them into. And at a certain capability threshold, they suddenly will be able to. But it's also probably a function of kind of, Nick, as you described, you know, companies release AI models, then other companies are building on top of them, trying to build services. Most of the ones doing the most innovative stuff are, you know, startups that are scrappy, and they are, there's been a seasoning cycle on the GPT-4 models where they're beginning to come out of stealth now. So there was a company, Bland, I think it's called, that has like a general purpose AI, phone answering agent. You can assign it to anything, but you could certainly imagine assigning it, to cold calling customers to try to sell something. And there's reason to believe that these systems, you know, when you get a call from somebody who is trying to sell you something, it is uniformly a terrible experience. Like, these people are reading off a script, you know, it's bad enough that you know, anybody who's like operating in the modern world immediately susses out that's what this person is doing and immediately disconnects, right? And then there's some class of probably elderly people who want to talk to somebody and then end up getting sold a magazine subscription or, you know, donating to a nonprofit that they don't even know what it does, right? You can imagine that like the design of the system to call people, it suffers a lot of translation error into the people who have the mind-numbing job of calling, you know, 500 phone numbers an hour or whatever. I think their throughput rate's actually much lower, and getting hung up on all the time. And so an AI system probably is going to end up being better at this and more persuasive, more measurable, and can do it at scale. And so I think that the kind of like the idea of cold calling, it probably will shift over onto these systems. And that'll, I'm not saying Bland is necessarily going to be the company that does it, but it certainly is a way that you could kind of attach revenue to the amount that's being spent on these systems that then will kind of like at scale make them more effective at cold calling customers.
Well, okay. I have a question just on that example, and I guess maybe it goes back to my prior point, but like that example, I think the terminology out there is like, it's an LLM wrapper. So you're wrapping a product around, like, you know, they're probably using some large LLM for the data and then they fine tune it.
Yeah.
How defensible is that, right? Like, okay, that is a great use of AI. I don't doubt that. I actually think that's a genius idea. But then you have people that understand this, and then, you know, how long does it really take to build a competing product? And that's where I have this issue of, okay, yes, there's a lot of use cases for AI. So much so that you're just going to have so many startups in this space, and they're able to push product at a pace we have never before seen in technology. And so to me, that's where it comes back to, I think, Sam's overarching point. How do you have pricing power in a highly competitive space? And what actually does end up separating out these companies if the underlying technology that is driving the product itself is available to everyone? Like, there's no defensibility around the actual language model powering.
Yeah.
Well, I think
think about software.
It's been true, but you've had to.
No, famously, like, anytime a software as a service product was released, people on, you know, I can't remember, is it Slack Overflow or Reddit forums would be like, oh, I could code that. Of course you could. Like, there's not some secret sauce going on in the back end of software as a service companies where they have some specialized coding talent that is unavailable to other people. And, like, making a performant system that people know how to use is the combination of kind of like the underlying technology. It's kind of your way in which you educate and onboard customers. It's the way the system performs in response to kind of customers, and, like, your ability to, yeah, adapt to what the market wants. And so I think that there is there's no reason why AppFolio, which does, you know, multifamily apartment rental management, couldn't be built on top of, like, Salesforce or any other platform, or be duplicated by somebody else who's like, I'm going to develop software that does this thing. If anything, AI actually has more defensible characteristics because you're, like, better able to feed customer behavior back into the system and improve it than you are with traditional software.
I agree, to the extent that you still, like, with the AppFolio example and just, you know, human created software, the human element is what is necessarily defensible and is what gives you the lead time to build a product that outcompetes newer entrants. But with AI, at least what we've seen so far, you don't have that lead time anymore. Like, there's a reason these companies are probably staying in stealth longer than, you know, prior. And I'm totally making an assumption here, but my guess is these AI companies are staying in stealth longer because as soon as you come out to market, the time it takes to recreate that product is vastly different than before we had this generative AI functionality. So, like, I totally agree with you.
Yeah. But think about this, like, the over the course of the last decade, two decades, the ease with which you can launch and deploy software has definitely compressed, even before AI, over the last three decades. Like, infrastructure as a service, all the platform as a service, it's definitely lowered the amount of capital you need to get to market with a product. The result, I would argue, hasn't been that there's only a few software companies. Actually, the number of software companies that are occupying kind of interesting and profitable niches has exploded. And the attributable software market cap has grown, not shrunk. And kind of like the mega cap tech companies have also grown much larger. And so I think it's actually a positive sum situation. It could be that, like, your incremental roll of the die has lower odds, but the company that, like, works and sticks then can just get bigger. Much bigger, you know?
Yeah. That's good for me. Yeah.
I feel like from this conversation, it does seem like more power accrues to the firm than the software.
To the firm, what do you mean?
Well, it's like distribution, marketing, every, you know, exactly what you're saying, UI, UX, support, it's like all of this becomes incrementally more important if the differentiator isn't purely software based.
But software has not been the differentiator all along, I don't think. I don't think that, you know, people, like, the software has to perform, but it's always been like your ability to get in front of customers, deliver value to them instantaneously, kind of have like a good penetration strategy into the enterprise. I don't know if there's a, if anything, what I see as different with AI that makes it challenging is that even the developers of the software actually don't know how it's going to perform. And so the kind of you are really dependent upon getting a product that gets into customers' hands that happens to work, and you don't know what it's going to be capable of. And a lot of the engineering effort is in trying to constrain it down into areas where there is like a higher degree of certainty of what it's going to do, which is, it's just different. And you could argue there's a, so this, again, the Bland company, you know, their pitch is, hey, it's an AI system, but it's not going to confabulate and, you know, like make up stuff for customers. Now we'll see if that actually happens and works, but I would say probably react allergically to the idea that they're an AI wrapper, because they see all of their value add as the way in which they are allowing people to constrain the conversations and drive them towards certain outcomes that they want without the AI sales agent accidentally offering the customer, you know, a truck worth $30,000 for $500 because the customer is a good negotiator, you know? And so I think
that might make it worse than a human, right? A good business development person's offering them something that engineering hasn't done yet.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that the one thing I'd say is that your worst sales agent can be very bad, like, and kind of an AI system in the wrong circumstances can also operate like poorly. And so the reason, and kind of circling back to the original point here, the reason to be on the revenue capture side rather than on the, you know, cost saving side is at least somebody is like paying only contingent on performance rather than being like, I'm going to pay for this thing. And yeah, I'm hoping by the end of the year, it'll be saving me money. You know, the unpredictability of these systems probably means that like paying based on performance is something that people will be a lot more comfortable with rather than kind of buying up front and then hoping that it delivers.
Mm-hmm. All right. That was a wide ranging discussion, but I think we learned. Did we learn? Brett, what did you learn?
I learned.
I did most of the talking. Nick, what did you learn?
No, I think you framed it in a way that I hadn't necessarily thought about it before when it comes to like the explosion potential of software, in that because the cost now to deploy software is so low with generative AI, you can actually deploy more customized software into smaller niches than previously were off limits because the cost to create software for this specific vertical just didn't make sense monetarily. The market's not big enough to actually build customized software. So that market just has to adapt to more generalized software. But now I think with generative AI, you will have a lot of startups go after these very niche markets and build customized software because the cost to do it is so low. And I think, you know, the Sam Altmans of the world have framed it, you know, there will be a one person unicorn. And I guess that right. kind of mindset trickles down to you'll have one person, you know, $100,000-$200,000 customized software solutions going after markets you don't even know about because it wasn't worth spending time there. But now you can do that. So that, I think that was helpful.
I think about it. There's a good theoretical chart that can be drawn. You know, people love like the smile curve, all those simple things, but it's like clearly there's a supply curve similar to like mining for enterprise software niche.
Yes. And it, at some point you cross a threshold where the cost of development is so low that you don't need your, and your specialized need is so specific that you're not going to rely on an outside vendor to provide that. Right. Instead, you enable the, you know, knowledge worker who's right out on the edge to just develop the software themselves. And that's why a platform like Replit or any of these, like, it's why the coding platforms are like the interesting spot to occupy right now in AI. It's because if it all disappears inside the firm rather than going to outside vendors, then there's still the opportunity to capture some of the productivity that's being yielded.
Interesting. I think it still leaves a question of pricing power and the amount of the way that you just ended it, Brett. Now I'm back to thinking, okay, there's going to be not a lot of, of revenue opportunity, because if you can just build something for yourself, you know, how do you charge for that? But yeah, it's an interesting debate. I don't know that we'll have an answer until we have the, like, it's hard to predict.
All right, we'll end it there. Obviously a live discussion, so drop comments. I'm sure some people will be insightful and others will be hurtful.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. All right, see everyone next week.
All right, thank you.